I listened to the previous podcast with, what's his name?
The one with Byron?
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah, thank you. I was very hungover, and I woke up like 15 minutes before recording. And yeah. I actually wore shades on the call because of how bad I looked. But we've been getting some
well,
good
you couldn't
reviews
tell at
for
all.
That. So I'm glad that came out well.
Yeah, you couldn't tell at all. I mean, you sounded very sharp as usual.
People really liked Varn yelling at me about having any optimism whatsoever for Zoran.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about it, but if you want, but I don't think for me, it's not necessarily about Zoran. It's about people embracing the deep hatred of the billionaires, talking about working class concerns. I think it's kind of like the Bernie phenomenon. Like, I cared less about Bernie and more about what it meant for thousands and millions of people who were like, who appreciated his politics and who believed that. So
yeah, I agree. And I mean, I guess we'll get into it because we are here with our Chicago correspondent, Jana, also our Bronx correspondent. So we'll talk about, you know, we talked about Brandon Johnson last week as like a possible look into Zoran's future were he to become mayor. But we'll also talk about the big, beautiful bill and the ongoing ICE terror raining down across the country and how that's come to Chicago. If at all. But maybe before that, we can just catch up a bit with Jana. You had a little summer trip last month, right? How did that go?
I did. I had a little Euro trip to escape America. And it was really nice. I went to Italy, France. While I was there, I saw some pro-Palestine protests, which were great. Towards the end of my trip, dock workers in Marseille stopped a shipment of that was going to Israel, and which then was reciprocated by dock workers in Genova, Italy, which was where I was going the following day. So the trip ended really on a high note of international solidarity. So I came back to the United States hyped, like, yes, I'm ready to get into the fights. And I came back to certainly a lot of fights. Also, the time that I was away in Italy and France, LA was erupting in anti-ICE protests. I was a lot on social media watching the images of folks in LA fighting back, which was really dope and amazing to see. So excited to be back.
Mm-hmm.
But then Trump's BBL, some are calling it, dropped, and it's pretty terrifying.
Some are calling it his big Brazilian booty lift.
Yeah.
By the way, Marseille is currently on fire. I don't know if you saw the news, or at least there's a wildfire encroaching on Marseille. So hopefully everyone out there is safe, and
yeah,
it's scary. But the
Yeah,
maybe we can talk about the BBL first. Big, beautiful Trump, his big, beautiful bill. Everything I know about it is just extreme austerity, cuts to the social safety net, tax cuts mostly for the extremely rich.
Yeah.
And then, of course, this huge expansion in ICE funding. I read an interesting article. This is, I thought, a good thing to talk to you about. From Mother Jones, where they interviewed three people who had worked in or directed or studied private prisons. And so the link to that's in the show notes, but I'll just read a few notes from that article. So they say the bill includes $45 billion in funding to build new ICE detention facilities. And these are specifically cut from Pell Grants, nursing home staff paid by Medicaid. And then apparently some of these nursing homes that have already been closed or will close are targeted to be turned into detention centers. So
wild.
Yeah.
Wild shit.
ICE wants to increase their capacity for detaining people from about 41,000 people a day to 100,000 people a day. And to put that in comparison, BOP's population daily is about 155,000. And BOP has 122 prisons. ICE doesn't have very many. I'm not sure how many they don't own any like the BOP does. They contract them all from Geo and CoreCivic. So yeah. What they're going to likely go ahead.
Sorry, no, I was going to say currently, and you know, things have been expanding in the past year or so, but there's about 200 ICE detention centers. And what complicates it a little bit is that some local jails have, and in some localities have these 287G agreements, which means that they contract with ICE to detain people in local jails. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a patchwork of detention centers, but for sure it's, you know, it's going to be supercharged, is going to be totally batshit crazy going forward with yep. ICE infrastructure.
Like, I think they're even using parts of the courthouse downtown, just like a floor or a couple rooms in the courthouse. And in LA too, they're just sort of keeping people in a basement. You know, they don't have the beds. So what they're going to have to do is pretty rapidly build temporary facilities. That was kind of the proof of concept of the Alligator Alcatraz, as they themselves are calling it. So they're going to build more of these tent concentration camp type things very rapidly. But then that raises a lot of questions, like who's going to staff them? You know, they need janitors, they need guards, they need, hopefully they will have some medical staff.
I don't know about that. Yeah, did you see the images of the food trucks that were going into Alligator, whatever,
Alcatraz or Auschwitz, whichever way you want.
It was wild. It was on social media and people were calling out the food trucks for doing that. I mean, the food trucks were going in to feed people who are working at the detention facility. Right. And ironically, some of the food trucks were, you know, Mexican food trucks. So people were like, how could you do this? Like, how could you, you know, go and, you know, bring food to people who are working in these facilities. This is terrible. So hopefully going forward, I think what has been happening is that there is kind of a growing consensus among a lot of ordinary Americans against ICE, and ICE is being delegitimized for, you know, a growing sector of the American population. So perhaps there could be a lot more confrontations for when things like that happen.
Yeah, actually, I'm going to play an audio clip for a second of one sort of MAGA guy who is very concerned about this. But just to finish up this Mother Jones article, and I want to talk to you more about this, too, because you're an expert on the subject of incarceration in the United States. But besides ICE needing to hire a lot of new people for these new concentration camp, prison type things, they have to compete with other public and private prisons that already exist and already have these kind of regimes for hiring. So that's going to be very costly and even pretty difficult, especially if they're building these rural facilities in the middle of nowhere where people can't really protest them, or, you know, in the middle of the Everglades where people can't escape or like go to, you know, get food. So a food truck has to come in. You know, how are you going to find the people to work in these facilities? Where are they going to live? Where are they going to eat? And then there's, on top of that, the Alligator Alcatraz specifically is comically unsafe. They've already reported flooding in their first week, and extreme heat. It's not air conditioned. And hurricane season is coming, and if it was anything like last year, it'll probably just get blown completely away. And so another level on top of that is Trump has been defunding part of the DHS that has civil oversight, you know, where you can report civil liberties concerns. They've defunded the ombudsman, who's responsible for investigating abuses in the detention centers. And conditions were already horrific under Biden, but now there appears to be no standards or oversight. So these really has the potential to just become a death camp if that's how the bureaucracy or the attitude of the guards or whatever wants it to be. That's what it can be. There's no way to stop it at this point. But people are not hyped about this, even people who were very enthusiastic about the concept of mass deportations. I'm going to pull up a screen for you. All right. This is a video this week from a man named Tim Dillon. Are you familiar with this guy, Jana?
Oh, yeah.
You do know this guy.
Oh, look at him.
He's a comedian. He's sort of in the Joe Rogan world. You know, I've heard of him before. He's one of the most popular podcasters, and I always just thought he was some idiot conservative guy. And I listened to him for the first time a week ago, and so this is the second episode I've heard. And I was pretty astounded that it was both much smarter than I expected and also much stupider than I expected, because he's very ironic. But he does say some pretty explicit things here. I'll play the audio in a second. And just keep in mind that right before the election, he had J.D. Vance on his show, and it was a very positive interview. So like Rogan, you're starting to see some of these very important influencers. This guy gets easily a million views per video and has nearly a million subscribers, start to get worried about Trump in a way that I don't know if it really happened last time. But here, I'll play about a minute of this.
Part of this money is this big, beautiful bill that they passed where they're going to use a chunk of it for the deportation of people. I've said, like Rogan and other people, that the immigration raids that are random are pretty barbaric. And I think they will ultimately lose support for Trump and the idea of having a secure border, which I think is an important thing. But because they are random, you're collecting people that are law-abiding, that have been in the country a very long time, that have committed no crime. You're picking people up in church parking lots at high school graduations. It's inhumane. And I think a lot of people feel that way. But in fairness to the Trump team, they did think of this and say, what if we put them all in a prison surrounded by alligators? Would that make it feel more humane? And it's that type of forward thinking that I think we should appreciate. Like, I think Trump and his people were like, sure, people find these raids to be a bit abrupt and, you know, soulless, unkind. But if we then took the people we swept up and put them in a prison built in an alligator swamp, would that make people feel better about it? So I think they're at least recognizing that their policy has been a bit controversial, and they're saying, how could we make it more palatable? If we got a bunch of gardeners who are in the country illegally and people are like, well, that seems a little fucked up. And you're like, hold on a minute. You don't know where we're taking them. And like, oh, where? To like see a judge or something? No, we're taking them to a fortress surrounded by lions.
Yeah. So he actually goes on, besides actually being concerned about humane treatment for the people that he himself advocates for mass deportation, he goes on to say, by the way, I am absolutely certain that these concentration camps are going to be used for U.S. citizens who, for example, criticize Israel. So this is, I think, becoming a little bit more of an unavoidable question amongst even the people who supported Trump. And him playing to his base of people who are like, great, throw them into the alligator swamp. I want them all to die. Is starting to backfire on what is his most popular issue, which is the border and immigration.
Yeah, I think in general, I think for sure that is happening. And for sure, between Joe Rogan, this podcaster that you just played, there was the MAGA boxer who on the, you know, in reaction to the LA protests against ICE made similar comments. I think what happened is, you know, and I know we don't like to see it this way, because if you talk to a lot of like liberals, especially folks like on social media, are like, well, this is what Trump supporters wanted. This is what you voted for. And I think there's actually a lot of people who didn't understand that this is what was going to happen, who didn't actually believe that Trump would go to such lengths that it would look this way, right? I think people, perhaps Trump supporters, had some abstract notion of how deportations would happen, how the border would be secured. I think they got bought in to this notion of criminality, that it would be just the quote unquote criminal illegals that would be rounded up. And, you know, unfortunately, that's also like a liberal narrative. Mm-hmm. you know, that has, in fact, in many ways, divided even the immigration justice movement. But, you know, clearly it wasn't just going to be the quote unquote criminal illegal aliens or so-called. So I think a lot of Trump supporters and MAGA supporters are backpedaling, and they're going to backpedal even more once Trump's BBL bill passes, because it's going to cut 21% of Medicaid. Is going to affect all of those folks that, you know, who may have voted for Trump but depend on Medicaid, who live in rural areas where the reason why so many rural hospitals are able to run is precisely because of Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And once that Medicaid is gone, rural hospitals are going to continue being closed. I mean, it's really going to be a shit show. So I think... you know, I think we're definitely going to see a lot of MAGA folks coming to perhaps a realization that this is not really what they wanted or what they voted for, or that this has gone too far. And the reality is that, some say it's too late. I'm not sure that it is so late in the game. I think what makes it really difficult with the ICE funding and the Big Beautiful Bill is that the development of ICE infrastructure is going to happen over the next 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I think like it's important because we could look at Alligator Alcatraz and say, oh my God, like this is going to pop up so fast. I mean, they build it in a week or something like that. But, you know, I do think that there's going to be also kind of like a long road ahead, and that long road is going to be full of obstacles, just like some of the things you highlighted, Andy, like who is going to staff this? Where are these facilities going to be built? The Alligator Alcatraz is being built, you know, like literally in the Everglades. You have indigenous groups, you have environmental groups who are saying this is horrific. So I just think it also provides folks who oppose these things opportunities to come together with strategies, to build like a movement against what's happening.
Yeah, we're certainly seeing that come together. And it is a big question about how fast this is going to happen. Yeah, the funding is over, I think, 4 years, but they could also just spend it all right away and then demand more funding. It seems like maybe that's what they're going to try to do, because they do seem pretty intense on getting to this million threshold, but then they're also starting to run up against the internal limits of that, which includes poll numbers turning around, but then also people from the business community saying, yeah, you can't deport everyone because this is like a plurality of the American workforce that you're targeting. You can't get rid of these people or else there won't be an economy anymore. And Trump is constantly wavering on that. And maybe there's some fears that he's going to try to do some reconciliation that more or less legalizes slavery, which has been proposed in the past. That was Bush's plan in the 2000s. There's also some talk about maybe there'll be another day without a migrant type strike. I've only seen hashtags promoting that thus far. But if things accelerate, and we've already seen what happened in L.A., and L.A. is sort of the test case for going to war against the undocumented / just Latino working class of a major American city, conflict will only increase. There's no real way to do this out of sight, out of mind, besides how the Democrats were handling it.
Yeah, I think this is a really crazy political moment. I just actually was at the socialism conference in Chicago this past weekend, which was during, you know, 4th of July, which at least it was nice to be with a bunch of socialists rather than, you know, I don't know, celebrating America, whatever. Nobody wants to celebrate America. This was kind of the sentiment beyond even socialism conference. But a lot of the speakers and some folks who were talking, having organized for a while in, you know, immigrant justice and issues related to immigration, were saying that, you know, made a really good point that I think is worthwhile repeating, that, of course, there's something really new and important about this moment in the ways in which Trump has accelerated, supercharged ICE, giving them carte blanche, going to spend all of this money to build these facilities. But we should always be mindful that, you know, he is following a wave of bipartisan consensus that has laid the groundwork for this, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this kind of puts the immigrant justice movement in a really important moment, because I think they have been one of the movements that's been very critical of the Democrats. And I think this could also be a moment that could kind of fuel those tensions that are going and are beginning to pop up and are beginning to show the contradictions in cities like LA, where you have a Democratic mayor, or you at least have like a kind of so-called like liberal worldview around immigration. This idea that these Democratic mayors are going to stand up to ICE. They're not going to allow for certain cities to, you know, to lose their sanctuary status. So I think that's a really important moment of struggle, and especially when it comes to the ways in which ICE and local police forces will or will not collaborate going into the future. I think also it's important to kind of also see that, the older forms of immigrant justice organizing, which has relied largely on these huge nonprofits to lead the charge in calling for demonstrations, in calling for these days of action, may also be met with more street skirmishes, more autonomous organizing. Something that's been really interesting in Chicago, for instance, is that while you have nonprofits like OCAD and others who have been integral in leading the pro-immigrant, anti-Trump actions, you are seeing a small number of autonomous groups that are pushing and are, you know, are creating these more like militant direct actions. There's been really wonderful autonomous support of the courthouse, right? Like for people for the past weeks in Chicago, individuals and autonomous groups have been going to the courthouse and doing court watch, blocking the entrances where ICE vans are entering. And those are actions that are not necessarily going to be condoned by these big nonprofits. So I just think this is like a really interesting political moment also, in terms of it's going to transform the landscape of even protest, right? And the ability of and to understand like how it's been unfolding.
So let's talk about the mayors and how these sorts of assaults on major cities might play out, because there was a chance that the way ICE would be used would be like purely sort of at the behest of the business community, like, you know, locking up workers who are organizing or something like that, or like Republican mayors who want to like turn around a certain neighborhood, like get these proletarian people out. We want to like raise property values of something. So it could have been used as a reward in certain like red state or red city places. But instead, it looks like the method is more a punishment for blue cities and Democrat cities. Mm-hmm. So it's really putting the onus on local Democrats to stand up. And I think this is a major reason Zohran did so well. And getting to Brandon Johnson, who we talked about briefly on the episode last week, because I think Varn mentioned him as an example of a progressive, I don't know if he's DSA connected or identifies as a socialist or whatever, but a progressive union guy from the teacher union world, I think, who is unpopular as his predecessors, Lori Lightfoot and Rahm Emanuel in this moment. But to his credit, he has called for Chicago to resist ICE, as has the mayor of LA, Karen Bass, who just yesterday went to this insane military invasion of MacArthur Park in LA. She like went down in her mayoral motorcade and, you know, told them to leave. And it turned out she probably didn't need to do this because the operation itself was a total clusterfuck. Did you hear about this?
Yeah. Also, I thought it was so interesting. It almost seemed like such a spectacle. This park is, there were like about like what, 20 kids playing there. It was this crazy, if you look at the images, it just looked like an insane spectacle of ICE strength. Very similar to what you would see, I don't know if you follow ICE operations on like TikTok or X. It's just like, it's always like, hyper-militarized men in masks doing this like crazy stunts. So it felt like that times 1,000. And then I just thought it was interesting. You see Karen Bass on the phone saying, you know, I'm doing my best to get them out of here. I don't know. It did feel like a little bit like a spectacle stunt kind of thing to me.
Yeah, on all sides of it, for sure. But yeah, just to go into this operation in MacArthur Park, Operation Excalibur, I think it's called.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, Operation Excalibur. Ken Klippenstein got some leaked documents from the 1st Squadron, 18th Cavalry, who was part of the U.S. Army. And they were asked to protect DHS security points and blocking positions while they undertook the assault. The squadron was ordered not to restrict pedestrian movement and not to conduct law enforcement activities. So basically they were there to just kind of, you know, be this military muscle behind this joint operation. But the joint operation involved dozens of federal agencies, including ATF. Not dozens, maybe one, like, let's see here. Yeah, a little over a dozen. ATF, CBP, DEA, FBI, FPS, HSI, ICE, USMS, IRS somehow.
Oh, my
and
God.
And, of course, Jesus. The LA Sheriffs and LAPD. And one funny detail is that on there, they had radio call signs for the operation, and they were all different kinds of soda. And ICE was Inca Kola, the Peruvian soda that tastes like cotton candy. You ever tried Inca Kola?
Oh my God, I love those things so much. Too much.
They're too sweet for me, but.
Yeah, no, I love them. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy too, because MacArthur Park is located, you know, it's in a neighborhood that has a lot of, you know, South American, Central Americans. It's like where kids play, there's street vendors. I mean, it's like such a well thought out location to do something like this, you know.
To terrify to normal people.
Yeah, to terrify people and to terrify kids, communities, right? Kids go there to play soccer, you know. Folks are selling things, you know, vendors, and it's so wild.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is how a lot of the country, or at least Trump's base, views Los Angeles. It's like, it's a foreign city. It's been taken over by these. You know, this is how Trump talks about immigrants. It's like, these are all murderers. You know, he talks about them kind of the way that the Israeli government talks about Palestinian people. And so it's very scary to see this kind of military mobilization. And it is of little comfort that they totally botched it with these different agencies showing up at different times. And really, I think what they were trying to crack down on here, besides the show of force, is that I guess is a place where some immigrants can come and get fake IDs to be able to work. And I haven't been to MacArthur Park in many years, but I assume it's a site of fences, which are like street markets of often stolen goods.
Yeah, there's a lot of
all over every major city, as far as I know. Yeah. So I think they're trying to crack down on these, like, you know, these illegal street markets where you can maybe get a fake ID, but these aren't entrenched locations. These can move easily. They can move to a back alley or someone's house. So it's a quixotic task.
Yeah. Well, I think it just speaks to, as you said, Trump's rhetoric, right? He's like, I'm delivering on exactly what I thought I would do, which is, I mean, what I said I would do, right? Which is going after, and again, if you look at like ICE social media, they're constantly, we are going after the most violent criminals. We have spotted, you know, we have found the place where they are congregating, where they're hiding. And I think in that sense, MacArthur Park fits into that narrative of what they think people like immigrants, Latino immigrants are up to.
Well, they also claimed it was like MS-13's home base because they claim that they were founded in that park. As far as I know, they're actually founded in prison. But I'm sure maybe the park has some significance to MS-13. But yeah, they sort of treated it like they were going to invade this MS-13 stronghold and the gang members would immediately open fire on them and they would become like a war zone. And I don't know how seriously they believe that or not, or if they were just Like, you know, I mean, this is how we got the Trump administration. It was this insane right-wing propaganda of, you know, cities being invaded and burnt down and turning into no-go zones. And so you get some people, you eventually replace all of the level-headed bureaucrats who understand that that's all rhetoric and propaganda with people who actually believe it. And you start staffing up ICE with essentially turning into like a fascist make-work program where you get all of the psychos who want to hunt down and abuse immigrants into a workforce, and they do it with zeal, whereas at least Klippenstein claims that the people in the National Guard and Army are just ashamed to be there, and compared it to Afghanistan. It's like, we're here for a mission that we can't win, that we have no actual role in, and eventually we're going to withdraw, so we might as well just do it immediately.
Yeah. And I think when I think about organizing and I think about this moment, I think about a couple of things. First of all, people living with all of this, right? So folks in LA, people around the country constantly living in this reign of ICE terror, right? When you don't know when things are going to pop off, you don't know how they will unfold, right? MacArthur Park being a good example of just like this show of force that's really insane to witness. But I also think about the fact that, you know, increasingly we're going to see military personnel being involved in these things, right? There were also military personnel deployed to Florida. So, I mean, we don't have like any anti-war movement, but I've been seeing things like Veterans for Peace holding, you know, some protests in front of Capitol Hill. I just wonder, you know, what kinds of organizing can we see that reaches out to folks in the military, in the army, who are, you know, who may be holding these contradictory beliefs, right? Who may see themselves as quote unquote defenders of the Constitution, blah, 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 but feel really morally, like feel that this is all really terrible, morally wrong that they can participate or do this, right? And I think they are a group that can be reached out to, I think perhaps a little bit different from the ICE agents, because I do think with the 10,000 new ICE agents that are going to be hired, I mean, I could see kind of like the worst of the worst wanting to have these jobs, right? So I don't know. I just kind of have been thinking also like in terms of organizing what this could look like going forward.
Yeah, I mean, and this is a very crucial question because I think we're at a moment where we can safely say that the people who are in charge of this country have fascist ambitions and very little impediment from the state itself. You know, they're quickly eroding any sort of checks, whether it be from the courts or from representatives. Like, the Democrats are a minority, but also they appear a very loyal opposition to Trump in most ways. So there's really nothing stopping them. And so if we're talking about ordinary people, whether they be in the army or in the bureaucracy or just in the street saying, I'm witnessing a bunch of masked men kidnap some gardeners right now. This is the crucial question, is how are people who are still have a shred of humanity, unlike the people who are working for ICE, going to resist this? And I think the wager of the big, beautiful bill is that, well, we don't need to have like normal people do these jobs. We'll get all the psychos into like the best funded law enforcement agency, and they'll become this ideological apparatus of repression. And that's what we're up against. Is ICE going to be seen as a pariah by the rest of the people, including something that absolutely needs to happen, is defections from the army and even police forces, right? I know listeners are rolling their eyes, but we saw in 2020 that as much as we saw police being repressive and violent, we saw a lot of cops just sort of quiet quitting, like, yeah, okay, if everyone hates us, I don't really want to do this job anymore. And so that
is not worth it. Yeah, for sure. And I think the thing is that in order to build movements, right, we also need to be talking to these folks and, you know, engaging with people, right, where they're at and how they're experiencing this moment. I think also making connections. When I think about the BBL, I think about how clear the task of the Trump administration and his little cronies is, right? I mean, J.D. Vance highlighted it so clearly, right? He said, you know, Medicaid, you know, all these social safety nets, it's immaterial to the needs to fund ICE, right? So the fact that they are cutting Medicaid, that they're gutting what little social safety net exists, which, you know, both parties have been gutting for a long time, for the past decades. But, you know, it's so clear that they're gutting these things in favor of $45 billion in funding for ICE and tax breaks for the billionaires. Like, that is insane. And I think just like the unfolding of the big, beautiful bill could also bring so many more folks to a different conclusion, right? To kind of seeing, you know, to be more critical of not only the Trump administration, but also the inability of the Democrats to have put a stop to any of this, right? So I think, I don't know, I'm just, in that way, I think there's just going to be so much happening. But what I fear is that a lot of the big, beautiful bill, minus perhaps what's going to be happening to ICE, is going to be such a slow process. A lot of this doesn't take into effect until like the midterms. So it's just like over 4 years. So it may not be that big hit that that would galvanize a lot of people is going to be over a period of time. And I think there's a way in which the danger in that I see is that it normalizes us to live with these things, right? It normalizes the fact that rural hospitals are going to be closed. It normalizes, you know, people being kicked off of Medicaid. You know, it normalizes like all these kinds of messed up things. So, you know, there's just so much uncertainty, but we just know that one thing is for certain, it's going to really mess up so many people. And it's really terrifying in that way.
Yeah. And I think you're right. Like it's not going to be all at once. A lot of these cuts are going to happen in 2 or even 4 or 5 years. So it's going to be more, you know, the hospitals aren't going to close all in the span of 1 year. They're going to close in the span of probably 10 years, actually. And there's going to be midterms and we're going to see how the Democrats react. I would not be surprised if they shifted to sort of more social democratic messaging about this. They've shown no indication of doing that so far, but they could. So I think it's crucial either way, no matter what, just for us to get organized and say, what we're witnessing is, we can call it fascism, we can call it whatever, we can call it the elites, an oligarchy, whatever you want to call it, but we're witnessing an active war on the working class of this country, and our politics are, we are on the side of the working class. We're not on the side of getting Trump out of power or, you know, restoring democracy or whatever. The Democrats, hopefully they'll do that on their own, but we have no faith in them to do it, so I think we've got to organize with a very clear position on this.
I agree. A very clear pro-working class, anti-capitalist messaging, because, you know, the terrain will get murky. And I think something that will add to that murkiness, which is really important part of how the bill will unfold, is that it's going to offload. I mean, what essentially Trump is doing, and, you know, it's kind of a continuation of, it's like Reagan on steroids, right? Where it's like, is devolving the responsibility of the federal government onto the states themselves, right? So when he's cutting and reducing funding from the federal government, who's going to pick up this bill? States, right? And states are going to now have to make cuts. They're going to have to tighten eligibility requirements. They're going to have to eliminate benefits, right? I was looking at the Medicaid bill because it's like, I grew up, my parents grew up on like welfare. I spent so many times in government offices. I feel like I'm a goddamn welfare policy expert at this point. But you know, my mom is on Medicaid and she's freaking out. And she's like, I know I live in New York, but like, I don't really trust these people. You know, what's going to happen to folks? So I kind of to like look at it more closely, you know, to talk with her through it. And it's kind of wild because like, even when we think about like Medicaid and how it impacts folks with disabilities. One in five kids are enrolled in what is called an optional group, that it doesn't have to be federal, it's not federally required to be covered, right? So these are kids who are not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid, who may be low income, who have disability, foster kids, right? So what all of this to say is that the state is going to have to foot that bill. And I think this is when we're going to see the importance of, you know, will these Democratic mayors, like, what will they do? Will they just be overseeing? And this is the danger, right? And this is, I kind of get the critiques of Mamdani and Johnson, is that we're technically going to have progressives in office overseeing austerity, mm-hmm. right? And then my response is, I'd still like to have at least a progressive overseeing austerity than some right-wing nut job. But I mean, that's essentially kind of what we're going to be seeing. It's going to put a lot of strain on the state. And so I think when we look at New York City, we're looking at all of that happening too, right? In Chicago and Illinois, they're already starting to grapple with like the budget, right? What's going to happen when all these cuts go through? I think in Illinois, like 330,000 people are being kicked off of Medicaid. So those are all people that then the state has to figure out what to do. So this is just like a, kind of interesting. And I know that sounds like very legislative and policy, but that impacts day-to-day decisions, right? Because then that means, well, what are the social services that the state is then going to cut to make up for this? Or how is it going to handle that? And this is what's interesting about what will happen with Mamdani, is that this is what he's up against, on top of the fact that he's up against a really powerful real estate sector, finance, a class layer of New York, not to mention the Albany legislature. So it's just like, it's kind of a wild, climate and situation.
Yeah. And sort of tying this back to the ICE raid stuff is, like we said, Brandon Johnson says he wants to fight in some way. Zoran says he wants to fight in some way. And Trump's response to this, I'll play the audio. This is from him having a nice meal with Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday in the White House.
He's not a socialist, he's a communist, and he said some really bad things about Jewish people, and he said some really bad things about a lot of people, and I think he's going through a little bit of a honeymoon right now, but he might make it. But it all comes through the White House. He needs the money through the White House. He needs a lot. He's going to behave. He'll behave. He better behave, otherwise he's going to have big problems.
There's obviously a lot of valid concern about them trying to denaturalize Zoran and deport him from the country. And we may certainly see that. That's not what Trump's talking about right now. Trump is saying he's going to win the election and he is going to need federal funds and we can turn it off. And then we'll see how well his communist New York is going to go once there's no federal funds. So this will be a major question. And then bringing it back to Chicago, we mentioned Brandon Johnson seems to have rhetorically at least the right footing on this. But also I found an article from The Hill about another Chicago Democrat, Alderman Raymond Lopez. Are you familiar with this guy?
Yeah.
He's pushed Chicago to tweak its existing sanctuary city policy, predicting that Trump's focus on Chicago was looming. Lopez previously accused the mayor of engaging in a political game of chicken with the president and is calling on the city to extend an olive branch. Lopez privately met with White House border czar Tom Homan, who believes focusing on migrant criminals who have entered the country illegally over the past 4 years instead of collateral arrests is more than enough to keep the administration busy and more than enough to allow the president to meet his goals. We are choosing to keep the target on the back, off the backs of our city and off the backs of our undocumented community by thumbing our noses at Trump 2.0, Lopez said. The federal government is bigger than the city of Chicago, and now we're going to feel it. And Adams is basically saying the same thing, which is like, okay, if we're trying to protect, if we don't negotiate with Trump, they're just going to arrest more innocent people.
He's trying to avoid getting a little cell in Rikers. But, yes, but I get it. I mean, I think in Chicago, it was not just Lopez. There was another alder person who basically try to roll back a little bit of the sanctuary city. And it was defeated, I think. You know, Johnson has been a really vocal, I have appreciated that he's been a very vocal opponent of Trump. But there's a lot of other issues in Chicago. I think Johnson is increasingly growing unpopular because there's been such a successful right-wing assault and conservative assault against a lot of his policies. Something I wanted to bring up was that very similar to Mamdani, Johnson campaigned on a tax for, you know, taxing the rich a little bit more. In Chicago, part of his first, the first big fight that Johnson had in Chicago was Bring Chicago Home, which was this plan where he would increase taxes on property sales over $1 million. And this was supposed to generate, I think, $100 million a year for homelessness in Chicago, which has grown a lot over the years. And it was defeated. The real estate sector went to bat against him, essentially went to war. The Chicago Tribune had opinion pieces saying that this was like the worst piece of legislation. This would be terrible for Chicago. It would ruin like affordability. I don't even know how that would ruin affordability. That's like insane. Like property taxes over $1 million. So basically, it was defeated, and it was something that was put up for popular referendum, right? So regular ordinary Chicagoans could vote on it, and it was defeated. And this was seen kind of as the first blow against Johnson. So the Chicago Tribune actually quite recently posted an article where they're warning New Yorkers and saying, hey, like, look at what happened to Johnson in Chicago. You know, this is what happens when you elect a socialist, he gets seen that way, a socialist mayor in the big city. He will get defeated. He will get nothing done. This is all rhetoric to get you to vote for him. But in reality, he's not going to be able to accomplish any of it. And I think, you know, this kind of brings me back to also the Bernie moment, right? Where people were like, well, Bernie's not going to be able to achieve any of these things if he becomes president. So I think that kind of like, opposition to Johnson with editorials, like right-wing think tanks, like Illinois Policy Institute, were really crucial.
Yeah, and you sent me one of these articles that has a pretty funny hook. And this is from, illinoispolicy.org in November 2023. Mr. Beef from the Bear is a mansion, according to Chicago Mayor's Mr. Beef. Plan. So just really a very condescending angle for this hit piece that is, I guess, was trying to rally people against voting for the referendum, against voting for the tax increase, which worked, claiming that this fictional restaurant, is Mr. Beef a real restaurant?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's featured in The Bear. They would be hit. Like your favorite restaurant in Chicago would be affected by this tax bill. But I think something that added to the confusion is that on the ballot, there were like so many things that were listed, which people were, it was not something that was very well explained, right?
Isn't the tax, if they're selling it, like if the tax is on the sale? So they're saying like, well, if the beloved characters from The Bear wanted to sell Mr. Beef, they would have to pay a higher tax to do so. So isn't that defending Mr. Beef? Like that won't that stop Mr. Beef from going like being turned into a wine bar or something?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they were arguing that the measure would have Bring Chicago Home would like tax all of these beloved Chicago institutions like bowling alleys and the restaurant and grocery stores. And this would be really terrible. And I think, you know, especially when it comes to taxes, like, I don't know about you, Andy, like I'm like, I don't know too much about taxes. So like, I think anything that explains tax policy, most people are like, whatever, man. You know, there's not a very robust understanding of how it all happens. So I think it was very easy for, you know, conservatives, right wings, the real estate industry, specifically the real estate lobby in Chicago and Illinois, to be able to defeat it, right? Because they could kind of make these off the wall arguments that a lot of people wouldn't understand to be false, right? Because, I don't know, taxes are hard to parse out. So, yeah, but 46% of voters supported it and 54 opposed it. So it was not a huge, not of a big difference, but obviously a big difference enough that it got defeated. And the measure was killed.
Why do you what do you attribute that to? Was it like low turnout, or like it only got out the petty bourgeois base or something?
Yeah, I don't know. I was like trying to look at different things that, you know, people are reflecting on. And I think it's like a couple. It's always never one thing, right? It's a few different things. I think it's the people didn't really take it seriously, right? That this would be a way to fund like social services, badly needed social services in Chicago. And, you know, so that was one thing. The ballot measure itself was, I think I heard it was very confusing for people. The way it was, you know, people had to vote on, they had to read through these, all these bullet points. I think the real estate industry did a really good job at scaring people. So I think it was just a bunch of things that came together, but I just only bring it up because I think it's important to recognize that when we look at Mamdani and his potential victory in New York, these are issues he's going to contend with.
Yeah.
And very different from Chicago. I mean, I would say that New York's real estate industry is far more fierce, far more powerful, and they're going to be a major bulwark. And so is Albany. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't know. I think also that that state local distinction between, you know, New York City and Albany is a really, is going to be a really important connection that is going to get very politicized as well, because Albany will not approve of all of the things that Mamdani wants to do.
Well, you know, I am, I'm currently seated here not in the nice AC in the communist corridor of New York. So, and you're of course wearing your hot communist summer cutoff that you bought immediately last week. And you're
so excited. Somebody made into a t-shirt. I'm like, oh my God, the internet and the world moves so fast. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, that stuff just gets done by AI. So no one even needed to think of it.
I can't believe I bought that damn t-shirt. I was like, I could have done this shit myself.
You should have.
Yeah.
One day you'll have to make your own hot commie summer DIY cutoff. But you are our Bronx correspondent, so I want to talk a little bit more about, you know, if we do have the New York Commune to defend ourselves from Albany and from Washington, which was proposed during the Civil War, but not in quite such a radical way. But this time,
Bronx is a good place to be, though. You know,
okay,
we are,
so this is what I want to talk to you about.
We are the only borough connected by land. We are high enough.
And the only borough. And the only borough that decisively voted for Cuomo. So that's what I'd like to talk to you about. We're going to do it on the other side of the paywall. So if you'd like to hear us talk a little bit more about hot communist summer and Jana's takes from the Bronx, we can. You can hear that at patreon.com/theantifada. Sign up for $5 a month, $10 a month, or with a discount if you sign up for the full year. We really appreciate you doing that. And we'll be right back.
All right.
Yeah, so what was the, what are you hearing from your Bronx friends and family about Zohran?